Hallo, Pasha, howdy. Welcome to another episode of The World of Heritage. My name is Mary Kane, and here with me is Liana. It's been a while since this podcast started 1 year on, and it's still going. We're still having fun learning and hearing stories from our colleagues, but today we have a special episode. Special episode in the spirit of Halloween.
I was really wondering how you were going to do that, Mary, and that was like beyond expectations. Yes, I'm really, really excited about today's guest because, as Mary mentioned, it is in the spirit of Halloween. And today's guest, please welcome Alison Galberi. Alison is a PhD student at the University College of Dublin. Her research is focused on the origin of Samhain or Halloween, examining archaeological sites in Ireland, including Rathcrogan, I hope I said that correctly, and Hill of Ward, alongside folklore, and what this can tell us about the history of Samhain.
Alison, yeah. It's great to see you again. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. How are you getting on?
I'm good. Thank you for inviting me. You know, it's the creepy season. I'm excited to be here.
Yay! All hail the Pumpkin King and the spirit of Halloween.
Yes, indeed.
Well, why don't we get started then? So for people All right. who are listening who may not know what Samhain is, can you just tell us a bit about it?
All right. So Samhain is one of the four festivals that originally divided the Irish year into an agricultural calendar. So I have a cheat sheet over here because I never remember the other three because I don't study the other three. So it's Imbolc, Beltane, Lunasa, and Samhain. And so these festivals served as landmarks in the year for when people needed to do certain things for either their livestock or their crops. For example, Imbolc is the beginning of lambing season. Beltane is the beginning of summer when herds had to be moved to their summer pastures. Lunasa is the beginning of the harvest season, and then you have Samhain. And Samhain was the end of the agricultural season. It was when all the harvest had to be brought in. It's also when the veil between our world and the other world was supposed to be at its thinnest. So that other realm where fairies, ghosts, and goblins lived. And so it was a time for celebrating the harvest, but it was also kind of a scary, spooky time.
I've never heard of Samhain before this, and I was like doing my little quick research, and then I was like, you know what, let Dr. Alison tell us more. And you said you've even done a landscape analysis of Halloween and folklore for your MA thesis. Could you elaborate a bit more on that research?
Yes, and I suppose I should also mention that Samhain has modernized into Halloween. So we still celebrate Samhain, and it's today Halloween. So for my MA research, what I had done was, because I've always been really interested in Ireland, I've always been really interested in Samhain, and obviously my background is in archaeology, and so I wanted to figure out how do you study the archaeology of an intangible subject like a festival. And so that kind of led me to using the medieval texts to study what was being said about Samhain, because the medieval texts are where we get the oldest information about it. And so it really is very complicated to study that, because obviously it's coming to us through a Christian lens. And there's great debate, you know, when did Samhain start and all of this. But for the landscape analysis, what I ended up doing was going through those medieval texts and doing my best to map out the locations of where those stories were taking place. And I say doing my best because a lot of those places, we don't know where they were, or we don't know if they even existed in the real world, or if they were someplace that was supposed to be in the she, in the other world. So the places that I knew where they were, I could put those on a map. Then there are places that we kind of guess where they were. And then I had just a random list of names. I was like, who knows where this place is? So I did my best with that. And what I was looking for was I wanted to see if there was a region or an area or maybe a type of space on the landscape that Samhain seemed to be occurring in most frequently. I was also kind of looking for, is there a specific type of archaeological site that, or, you know, some sort of, you know, not just archaeological site, but sort of something on the landscape that seems to be drawing people in for Samhain. And you know, looking at the map that I created, it is a mess. It is a hot mess. There are sites all over the place, which is great. It means that it was observed all over. There was an emphasis on the quote unquote royal sites, which those, again, you know, in the realm of complicated things with Samhain and Irish myth, you know, the sites that in Irish myth we call royal sites weren't actually occupation sites. Archaeology suggests they were ritual sites or they were burial grounds. So, you know, there does seem to be an emphasis on death and on these royal sites, but also on journeys that are going from the northeast of Ireland to the southwest. And so, you know, that's kind of something that I thought was pretty interesting. And so then I was hoping to kind of clear up some of the landscape issues with the folklore and my PhD, and it just got even more complicated at that point.
I wanted to actually ask you in the midway. I was like, oh, so was there actually a concentrator? But no, it's just like a big jumble. I'm sure like you had like, okay, pinpoint here. And then like, but was there some areas more like, because you're mapping them, right? Was there more concentrated areas than others? Did you feel like, okay, this big circle I can draw here and I can make this relation to the medieval texts that you found or the burial grounds? Like,
not really. And like, I was really surprised, but you know, as we say, you know, negative results are still results. But what I did find, as I said, you know, there did seem to be more of a more frequent return to those royal rites, particularly Tara, which the festival of Tara, which was supposed to be a major kingship festival, took place at Samhain. So that made sense. But then the other one is Rath Croghan in Roscommon. And so there was frequent returns there. But really what seemed to be the most important thing was just following Cú Chulainn, who is Ireland's epic hero. So, you know, there seems to have been more of an emphasis on that and also kind of using Samhain as a storytelling device. So, but no, like nothing that I could, that really solidly that you could circle on a map. So As I said, I have a collection of really interesting jumbled maps.
I'd love to see those maps, just like considering that your research has been on it. I'm certain it must be very colorful.
Oh, it is. It is. They are color-coded little push pins all over the place. Yeah, it's great.
Perfect. I have like strings everywhere. I'm like, right, this connects to this. Like it's some conspiracy theorist cave maps.
Very much so. I mean, I have had that map, like I had a giant map of Ireland that I was like, can I push pin this in? Like, where does it go? Like, I mean, I've done it all trying to do those maps in the early days, trying to figure out before I knew how to use GIS.
Yeah, before that comes into play.
Yeah.
The fun map making exercises.
Yes. Yes. Google Earth was my friend.
Oh, yes. So I'm curious, because you mentioned that there were three other, I guess for lack of a better term, like pagan festivals that went on, like that are part of the Irish calendar. What specifically drew you more to Samhain compared to the other three?
Honestly, it's because I love Halloween.
Yay!
I am that person. I loved Halloween. And when I found out that it was Irish, and I was just like, oh, this is it. I am going in. I'm going to study Samhain. And actually, it's been really great because I remember when I first went to my master's supervisor, because I had gone, I went to Ball State University in Muncie, Indiana for my master's degree. And I knew I wanted to do something in Ireland, but I didn't know what. And I remember going to his office and being like, you know what I really want to do, like in the perfect ideal world, I want to study Samhain, but I'm sure that's been researched to death and that there's just nothing left to do. And he goes, actually, no one is studying Samhain. It's completely untouched. So you wouldn't step on a single toe if you wanted to do that. I was like, oh my gosh, this is fantastic. And, you know, going through the research that's been done over the literal centuries, it's true. Like people have studied modern Halloween and like there's lots of great research on Halloween as part of our, as part of Irish culture, as part of Northern Irish culture, as part of American culture, as a global phenomenon, but no one seems to have really wanted to touch Samhain in academia. So it's been great.
I'm real estate.
Yeah.
So for your PhD, were you able, I'm not sure if you went with this direction, but did you conduct any interviews with people? And if yes, who was the most helpful person you talked to?
So I have not conducted any formal interviews. And the reason for that is because Ireland is home to one of the largest folklore collections in Europe. It's housed right here at UCD. Woohoo! Part of my usual spiel right there. So the National Folklore Collection here at Ireland is so cool. It's really millions of pages of folklore that's been collected from the late 1920s all the way up to today. They're still actively collecting. And there is a lot of material available on Halloween that, again, just hasn't really been gone through yet. And so with all of that material that was available specifically from 1937 to 1939, and then 1939 to 1940, you know, well over 1,000 documents that people have handwritten and sent in talking about their personal Halloween traditions, you know, there was no reason to really go and start interviewing people. And again, like I said, modern Halloween has been studied. I wanted to try and reach back a little further, and using the collection from the 1930s, a lot of the informants who were giving that information were actually discussing traditions from the 1800s and telling, you know, well, you know, I'm in my 70s. And when I was a little girl, this is what we did. And so, you know, it's really kind of reaching back into, again, sort of getting into periods that haven't been studied that much yet. But that being said, when you tell people that you study Halloween, people want to come and tell you what they do. And I love that. Like, I love when people come up to me and like, I just want to tell you what my family does. My family has an odd tradition or a unique thing that we do, or even a not unique thing, but you know what, you might not know about this. And my absolute favorite was I went to a event up at the Hill of Ward a few years ago, and I was teaching people about folk games. And we were talking about, one of the things was bobbing for apples. And this little old lady came up to me, she had to be in her 90s. And she's like, oh, you know, when I was a little girl in Dublin, we used to play, but we didn't bob for apples, we bobbed for coins. And I said, coins? How do you bob for coins? And she goes, oh, well, you know, I mean, there's a trick to it. You got to put your face right down into the water, pucker up and go. And I'm like, okay, so I now know how to go bobbing for coins. And I love it.
Bobbing for coins, though, is a bit difficult. At least with an apple, it's floating. A coin, I feel like you have to just dunk your head in and just up. It's like, I'm swimming blind here.
It is definitely the expert level. And since then, I have found actually reference in the folklore to you either bobbed for apples, bobbed for coins, or bobbed for both.
That's so much fun. I remember I wasn't allowed to do it when I was 4 years old. My mom was like, no, you can't bob for apples. I was like, but why?
You'll drown if you do that, dearie.
And then she was like, yeah, but you're Snow White and you chose to wear red lipstick. You're going to ruin the lipstick. That's why you can't bob for apples.
I mean, it's a good reason.
Exactly. Reasonable. I chose the red lipstick for Snow White. Anyway, I'm really fascinated about like all these handwritten letters, and I came up with this, like, I really want to ask you, how important do you think digitalization here would play this role? I mean, when it comes to, like how much, in your opinion, does digitalizing impact the conservation of these letters and these people's stories? Like, do you think it's effective for the long-term sustainability, or do you prefer like actually physically touching these letters and I don't know, jumping into the mind of these people and reading their stories? Or what do you think about digitalization and people's stories? Basically,
personally, I am a huge advocate for digitalizing these resources. So for the research that I'm doing with the folklore, the collection from 1937 to 1939 is called the school's collection, and it was collected by little kids during the school year, and their teachers actually gave it to them as a homework assignment, and they then hand wrote the results and sent them back to Dublin. That collection is available in its entirety online. It's been completely digitized. You can go in, you can access it, you can search it. It's great. And, you know, especially like right now with COVID and all that stuff, it was so important to me that that was available online. And, you know, also, you know, working when you're starting talking about things like, you know, in Ireland, we have the Irish diaspora, where, you know, after the famine, people from Ireland were just leaving in droves. And so you have descendants of these people who want to learn more about Irish history. And here's a great way to do it. It's straight out of Ireland, straight out of the out of the mouths of babes. Here is Irish folklore, and it's available to you. And I think that's huge. And yes, you know, it is absolutely, it's wonderful, like an almost religious experience to get to go into the archives and to handle the books and get to turn the pages and actually, you know, smell that old paper smell, you know, the old book smell.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, that is wonderful. And there is, you know, that archaeological excitement of no one else has handled this in decades. But it's also, you know, it's conservation for that material as well, because some of those books are starting to fall apart. They're old, and especially like the ones that the little kids wrote in. So they would write in these little booklets. And then those little booklets were then copied into big books. And so the big books are the ones that they usually let people handle. But you can also go and ask for those little tiny, basically folded pieces of paper. And, you know, it's, you know, how do you preserve those and how do you protect those, but also make them available to people? You digitize them. So I think it's huge for access and for, you know, a world that's getting smaller and smaller by the day. For academics who are scattered to the winds, you know, and especially again in this day when we're talking about things like, you know, having different fields working together or having different countries comparing their own experiences. I think it's huge. I think it's so important.
Yeah, definitely. Which, by the way, thank you for sending me the digitized database of all the folklore for, what was it, Britta's nominating a site to go on the World Heritage List. That saved me a bit, the folklore collection.
Yes. You're welcome.
Yes, cheers for that. So, Allison, like myself, you are an American abroad. What drew you to go to Ireland? Because that's the question, you know, we all get asked.
Oh, yeah. Well, and again, you know, it's that whole, I came here knowing what I wanted to study. I wanted to study Samhain's origins. And what a better place to study Samhain's origins than where it originated. And, you know, so I'm here able to access these incredible databases and talk to these people who have been studying it all of their lives. I'm able to go to the sites that are so important. And so, you know, that's what really drew me here, was that I could do my research and do it justice. You know, and again, of course, with digitization, it's easier to go, you know, to be doing this stuff abroad, but there's also aspects of it that's just really difficult to do abroad. And so that's what drew me here. And I've absolutely loved it. It's just, it's been wonderful.
Ireland calls us all to the land.
It does.
So I'm curious, like during your research, have you come across similar holidays of Samhain? I mean, I can think of Day of the Dead, celebrated by Mexicans on November 1 and 2, just celebrating life and their relatives. And it's like more of a joyous thing. And I don't know how similar you could relate it, but have you come across other things that we may have not heard of? I think it would be worth mentioning.
So not really. I haven't. So that was a big thing when I started this for the PhD, was am I going to really start studying other cultures' death holidays? Because they are, I think death festivals and harvest festivals, they're so interesting and they're so cool to see how people do this. But we said there's just so much material for Samhain that I haven't delved into it too much. That being said, I do have people coming up and telling me about, again, you know, I don't celebrate Halloween, but in my country we do X, Y, Z. And so I've actually found a couple places, where did I just hear, maybe Poland, that instead of Halloween, it's more like Day of the Dead. It's, you know, November 1 and 2, and you go to the cemetery and you clean off the grave. And, you know, so more stuff like that is what I have found. I also studied Samhain in Scotland, and so Halloween practices in Scotland, which aren't entirely identical to what was happening in Ireland. So, you know, there were some differences there. But yeah, so not really. Unfortunately, not yet.
So I do have to ask, because in the age of COVID, doing graduate studies or doctorals is, it's already a challenge before, but now it's, you know, even better. So I have to ask, like, what has been so far? Because I think it's like the last time we chatted, you were like reaching near the end of your work, unless if something's happened.
Yeah.
But what would you say has been like the most challenging aspect of researching Samhain?
So with COVID and all of that, so probably the most challenging part, this was so frustrating, but again, thank everything for digitization. But I was really focusing my Halloween, my folklore research on a database from 1939, 1940. And so that was the Irish Folklore Commission, in 1939, sent out a questionnaire to people around Ireland, asking them specific questions about Halloween that had come about as a result of the responses that they got from the school's collection. And so this was a much more manageable collection. There's only, I think it was just under 400 responses. So, I mean, it's a decent sized collection, people answering specific questions about Halloween. Perfect. Like, this is what I'm going to use. And unfortunately, because the nature of folklore and the nature of the responses, like putting together an actual database that you don't then have to go back to the original source material, is tricky. So I made what I call a database, but it's much more of an index. And so I was relying on being able to go back into the archives to write that the folklore portions with my index telling me, okay, so these particular entries talk about lime kiln traditions, and these particular entries talk about wells, and these ones talk about rivers. And COVID hit. And that collection is not available online. And the archives had to shut down because of COVID. And so I was completely cut off for over a year from my material. And I was supposed to be submitting in that time.
Oh my God.
And so what I ended up having to do was basically start from scratch with the folklore using the school's collection, which was online. And so, I mean, it was definitely a, you know, kicking myself because, you know, if I had just done the school's collection from the beginning, you know, it wouldn't have been an issue and it would have been the easier one to use. But I mean, it's also a much larger collection. There's well over 1,000 entries from the school's collection. And so then it becomes, well, how do I pick which ones do I use? Do I actually need to, you know, whittle this down? So I was basically starting from scratch on the folklore. And that has finally all come together. And so thankfully I was able to get extensions on my thesis submission. And so like I'm getting back on track and everything and able to actually write these sections out now using the school's collection. But I mean, that was such a blow.
Oh God. No, that I shed tears for you. That's just such awful thing.
Thank you.
You shed tears while laughing.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like Schadenfreude tears. Like, on the one hand, it's like, I am amused by it because it's like the struggle, like everyone doing a PhD has to go through. And at the same time, it's like, no, that genuinely is awful.
I mean, and frankly, it was on par with the rest of my research. Like, when I was working on my MA, I had done all this research into the medieval texts, and my supervisor looked at it and went, there are more recent translations of these. So you have to read.
Oh, no.
Oh, and by more recent, he meant instead of 1893, there was a publication from 1903. But I had to use the more recent translations. I had to reread and reanalyze everything just in case there was a word difference somewhere that would have an impact. So it is on par with what I went through for the master's thesis as well.
It's so nice when your lecture tells you, it's just like, you done goofed.
Yeah. I'm like, ugh, these are the ones we used in class. Yeah, because they're easier to access. You gotta go get the other ones.
Dang it.
Why didn't you tell me this sooner?
Right? Why didn't you tell me this 200 pages ago?
Nice. Oh, no. Deceptions every day.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So really, I'm cursed is the moral of all of this. And yeah.
Well, you are working with Samhain, so that might be the first part of it.
It's fitting. It is fitting.
Yeah, I'm curious. No. This is just a side note, but how has UCD actually handled this? Because I'm assuming, like, no one is going to be graduating on time if they started, like, when COVID started, or even starting the fall before it happened.
So we were from March 2020 on until this year, September of this year, we were all off campus. Everything was done distance learning. They were granting COVID extensions for just about every degree. Someone commented they're passing out extensions like candy, because I mean, what else were they going to do? I mean, like you said, like, people were separated from their research, they were separated from their labs, they were separated from, you know, their professors who were helping them. And then you see this huge uptick in mental health issues as well because of all this, like, you know, I mean, and so really they've done a good job with that they've been very helpful to try and get people back on campus and sort of be like, when nobody else was allowed on campus, they were making exceptions for people with active experiments going on in laboratories, and they would have to take a COVID safety course before they could come onto campus, and they had to be able to, and so everybody's movements were tracked. I right here in this chair, in this room, from March 2020 until the end of September. And this year, for just getting things started up again and getting everybody back on campus, they had the first year start 2 weeks late. Mm. And so there were going to be fewer people on campus there at the beginning when everybody was getting used to being on campus, because, as you said, like, the second years had never been on campus before. So they were kind of trying to figure it out. And so they said, rather than having two massive classes figuring out how to get around campus at the same time, we're going to have the first year start 2 weeks late. And so, yeah.
So going back to, I guess, what's sort of been said about, like, studying other cultures and their festivities for celebrating the dead, this is probably going to be something if you'd want to do for a postdoctoral, but would you maybe consider studying Samhain in other traditionally Celtic-speaking countries and seeing if there are similarities, where there's differences, and still looking at it from the lens of folklore and archaeology?
Absolutely. I would love to do that. I toyed quite a bit with going to Scotland and kind of seeing things there. As I mentioned before, I kind of have brushed to the surface of what it was in Scotland. And so more 1700s kind of material. And Scotland also has a rather large folklore collection. The problem is that it's largely not text, it's audio, and it's audio in Scots Gaelic, and I don't know Scots Gaelic, so I'd have to learn Scots Gaelic first before I could take on that particular project, but it is something that I'm very interested in doing on down the line, and just kind of, you know, what exactly, you know, how far did this spread, and, you know, again, because there is quite a bit of debate with Irish medieval tales in general, so the Irish mythology in general, there are aspects that people are like, this must have come from the continent, because there were people in the Iron Age and the early medieval coming from the continent and moving into Ireland, and so what aspects of these things were brought from the continent and brought into Ireland and then stuck, and what are these are actually native, and so that would be interesting to kind of start going abroad and seeing just how far does this spread, and, you know, where can we track Samhain to? So yeah, long story short, I would be very interested in doing that. Yes.
Any chance to go to Scotland? I'm just going to say, do it. Just do it.
We'll see. We will see how that goes, if it goes.
Thank you so much, Allison, for those amazing answers. I'm really excited to hear more of the fun parts of Halloween, which is going to be in part two of our discussion today. Yeah, so stay tuned.
And welcome back to part two of our Halloween special with the World of Heritage podcast. So, Allison, since Halloween is nearly upon us, or listeners, depending on when you're listening, it is either the day of Halloween or after, whatever time in year it is. Time has no meaning anymore. So Allison, as you've been living abroad in Ireland now, you've been studying the origins of Halloween. Which do you prefer, Halloween in the States or Halloween in Ireland?
This is hard for me to say, but I prefer Halloween in the States because we Americans take everything far too seriously. Like, I mean, we have like, by far too seriously, I mean, we take everything up to astronomical levels that it should never be that about Halloween. For Halloween, you know, so I love being able to go to any store and getting tons of really either really kitschy kinds of Halloween decorations or getting like really pretty Halloween decorations and people going all nuts and, you know, trick-or-treaters everywhere. And in Ireland, it's like, yay, this is our festival and its origins are here.
And a lot of bonfires.
We have decorations in the store for 2 weeks. A lot of bonfires. And you might see 5 whole trick-or-treaters. And like, that's it. So it's not taken, so it's not as big of a deal here as it is in the States. And so I kind of miss that. I miss that atmosphere of that whole month of October is Halloween. And I kind of miss that.
So other than buying decorations and seeing all these big, crazy things happening at the stores in America, what are some of your favorite Halloween traditions?
So, oh gosh, let me think here. There's so many really cool things. So like for the modern things, like the very modern, if you're going out into the street today, I do love seeing little kids going out trick-or-treating. Like, I just love that. They're so little, like trick-or-treat. They're just adorable and I love it. I also, so like from the folklore, my absolute favorite though is an old tradition. So Halloween, again, having, you know, this is the time when the veil between our world and the other world, if that is thinnest, that means that, you know, so there could be interaction between us mortal humans and the fairies and the dead. And it also means that magic, divination that happens. And my favorite traditions that pops up in the folklore, and I am just desperate to know if anyone still does this. Like, I really want someone to still be doing this. Young ladies would go at midnight to the local lime kiln with a put into the lime kiln and then start to reel it back in. And if they felt a tug, they'd stop. And they'd say something along the lines of, "Who holds my yarn?" or "In the name of the devil, who holds my yarn?" and expecting, hoping to hear the voice of their future husband tell them who holds the yarn.
And it was about something related to their love or something.
Of course.
Of course it's yarn that their husband will be holding.
Yeah. Anytime ladies get
it's been so much fun because in
it's
the school's
got to do something with men.
Like, love in the school's collection, you know, with all the little kids talking about, you know, oh yeah, the girls go and they do the thing and you go at midnight and it's super spooky and you hear the voice of the devil or you hear the voice of your future husband. And then in the questionnaires, a few of the responses were, well, it died out in my area because the young ladies realized that what was happening, because they were getting responses and they weren't expecting responses. Like, you know, it's one of those things that like, you go and you do it because it's a good laugh and, you know, you and your girlfriends are going to go and, you know, oh God, we actually heard a voice and now we're terrified and we're sprinting from home and, you know, Father O'Brien was right and we're all going to hell. And well, apparently what was happening in some areas at least was that the young unmarried men were going out right before themselves into the kiln.
Ah.
And so when the yarn would come in, they'd grab it and listen. in for who, which girl is it, and which one of us wants to marry her, and the one who wanted to marry her would respond, and then they're all, and all the girls are going, what, no, oh no, and then taken off running. And so once the girls found out that that's what was going on, they're like, oh no, we are done, we are just done with this. And that was you know, seems to have been sort of the end in some areas. There were also a few areas that said that the local priest would refuse to hear your confessions ever again if he found out that you did it, because it was too close to witchcraft.
Of course, we gotta get the church in there somewhere.
Sounds like so much fun. Like the guys doing that as a response to the girls. I think it's so much fun, especially like, you know, at the young age of, you know, you don't know if it's real, let's go for laughs, and then suddenly it's like, oh shit.
Like, oh my god, he's actually
like, love so it. And like, I haven't heard of anyone still doing it today, but I really hope someone somewhere is still doing this.
Maybe someone, maybe in the Gale Talk, maybe.
Yeah. That would be my favorite. Maybe in the Gale Talks, in the Irish-speaking regions of Ireland.
Yes.
That's my
favorite.
Further
research for it.
The other really fun ones. Yes. Further research. I do think another interesting thing going on now, and again, like, it's interesting kind of looking at Halloween traditions just because of what it tells you about the culture. In the United States right now, we're seeing an uptick in a new Halloween figure called the Switch Witch. And she is, you take your bucket of candy that you got trick-or-treating and you leave it out for the Switch Witch, and she will take your candy and replace it with a toy so you don't eat all that candy.
Kind of like the fairy godmother, you know, you leave out your tooth to get money, but instead of money,
instead of
so
leaving
some
your
of the candy,
instead of leaving your rotten teeth from all the candy you would have been eating, it's just like, here's something else.
But why would the witch be nice?
I don't know. I mean, I guess when you eat that much candy, you're bound to be sweet.
Nice play, Allison.
Thank you. I'm here all hour.
Right. So I have a speaking of like trick-or-treating, so
yeah.
Imagine you are a youngin'. You're going trick-or-treating. Your parents are like, right, you have to have a partner with you. You've got a few options as to who you could take with you for trick-or-treating. You can either take Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, a werewolf, Jekyll and Hyde, and this is also under the rule of they can change back and forth while you're trick-or-treating, or Cthulhu.
This is a complicated one. I mean, I really want to take Dracula because, I mean, it's Dracula. Come on. I mean, I love Dracula. Frankenstein, he's so sweet, but he's also kind of scary, and I'm afraid he's going to step on me, you know? Was a werewolf. A werewolf was another option there. Can the werewolf eat chocolate? I mean, this is an important question.
Let's assume.
And if they can
yes.
eat chocolate, are they going to steal my chocolate?
Let's assume they can eat chocolate, but
well,
I'd
be in fear for my chocolate then. I mean, you know, I mean,
well,
how strained are
to eat more than you? So.
I don't know. And then Dr. Jekyll, that would solve that issue. I mean, that might be kind of nice, you know, kind of fluffy and a nice little thing to hold on to, you know. I like that idea. Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde just feels like you're asking for trouble. I think not. Cthulhu. Mary knows I am obsessed with Cthulhu, and like, my household be eaten last. I mean, that might be the way to appease the dark one, the elder gods. Yeah, I think I might have to go with Cthulhu. Anything to extend my lifespan after he rises from the depths. Yes, I'm going with Cthulhu. Thank you.
Brilliant answer. I'm so entertained by this whole thing.
I'm curious, Liana, turning this question onto you now.
You.
Who would you go trick-or-treating with?
Well, I think werewolf, I would still only see, just because at first I was thinking, yeah, Dracula, but then when Allison said something warm and fuzzy to hold on to, I don't know how Halloween weather is like in America, But I feel like if it was in Germany, I'd be cold. So I want something warm to hold on to. So yeah, werewolf is my answer. That's and if they eat more chocolate than me, then it's fine.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
I think, like, my mom and I were actually just discussing this yesterday, how cold it is for Halloween. And that, because in the States, like, it is, you're getting into that cold, wet, icky weather. And that, unfortunately, it's the time of year that you still don't know where your hat and gloves are. So for my she has little friends who are, you know, she's like a substitute grandmother for a couple of little kids. So every year she buys them a trick-or-treat bucket, a new hat, and new gloves to go trick-or-treating.
That's sweet.
So, you know. But yes, take the wolf man instead. Sorry, werewolf. Werewolf, wolf man, werewolf?
One or the other. So we got a werewolf and we got Cthulhu as our
chicken. But Mary, you didn't answer yet. I want to know. What about you, Mary?
I think I'd have to go with Dracula.
Cthulhu. She's taking me.
Yeah, I'd have to go with Dracula.
Why? This one.
Oh, like, I mean, it's the Lord of Darkness. I mean, yeah, not the same level as, you know, the Elder Gods and whatnot, but still, it's like, yes, it's the King of the Night, the no-life king, Nosferatu. I'd have fun with that. And if it were Christopher Lee's, like, Dracula, I'd be like, holy, yeah, hot damn, I'm having fun with this. That or, what's his name?
Yeah, I guess, too, there's that whole can vampires. Yeah, like if you're afraid for your candy, like, can vampires eat human food? And if not, then that would actually be a pretty good choice. Because
I mean, I just stick a clove of garlic in my basket, just going like, well, you're not touching my chocolate, so that's for damn certain. Yeah, no, if I had Christopher Lee's Dracula,
just a giant carved out bulb of garlic.
Yes. Yeah. No. Christopher Lee's Dracula or Gray McTavish's Dracula from the Castlevania series. It's like, right, I'll take one of those two, please. That'll be great going around trick-or-treating.
Those are both good options. I like them. I'm sticking with my Cthulhu answer, though, because, you know, again, may my household be even less.
I'm also thinking right now, can I change my answer? Like, what about one of the ghosts from Hogwarts?
There's a thought.
One of the ghosts from Hogwarts. Yeah, like
the snake or something. He would be talking the entire time. I'd be entertained as fucking, like, we'd be having such a good laugh. I don't know. Maybe.
Oh, I should have done one
that,
where
that would like, be right, fun. Like,
no, I was gonna say, you know what I should have done? I should have come up with, like, you gotta go trick-or-treating, but you have to pick something, someone from mythology, like a spooky thing from mythology. So it's like, do you want to go with a banshee? Do you want to go with, well, werewolf's already been done for it, but what's the name, Allison? I always butcher the name. It's the equivalent of the headless horseman in Irish. It's like the Dunahine? He's like the headless horseman that has like a
whip
made of vertebrae. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, headless horseman of Ireland.
Yes, yes, he is awesome. I like him. Did some research on him a little while ago. That was great. He's cool. If you hear him coming, you're going to die.
Yeah, that was all of us. There was an excavation in Clondalkin, and I think it was like travelers left like horses in our fields, and it's foggy this day. I'd like to point that out. And they just start coming in towards the site. It's like, oh shit, the Dunahern's going to come and he's going to kill us all. Oh no. There goes my career.
We're dead. Yeah, Ireland is full of, so you have the Dullahan, but then you also have just headless coaches or dead coaches, where if you hear the horses coming, your life is in peril, and if you see the coach, you're dead. There's no coming back from seeing it. And there's one in I can never remember that place. It's called the really large shopping center there by UCD.
Is it near Black
Dundrum?
Oh, Dundrum, that's it.
No, it's Dundrum Shopping Center. There's a headless coach in Dundrum, but instead of the coachman being headless, it's all six horses pulling the carriage are headless.
That's
horseless horses.
That's nice.
Headless horses. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
that's not frightening at all.
I like it. It's from the folklore in a couple people responded. So it's just that area is called Dundrum.
Oh,
and so in the folklore, they said in Dundrum, there is, so somewhere in right around, so that it just happens that when you think of Dundrum, there's a giant shopping center there, and that's the only way I can ever explain it.
Yeah.
So yeah, there's a, that area is Dundrum, and somewhere in that area, there are apparently 6 headless horses.
I didn't realize Dundrum would be going
on them or see them, you will die. Who knew?
Who knew? Dundrum. Oh, I didn't realize you had 6 headless horses walking around somewhere. Oh, geez.
So I'm going to go back to our questions because we digress.
Okay.
Another fun one then. What are you going as for Halloween this year?
I'm going as a kitchen witch.
Kitchen witch. Ooh.
Describe, please.
Yes, so a kitchen witch, they pop up in various countries' folklore. So it's a witch who basically haunts your kitchen. And usually they are nice and will help you in your kitchen and help you with
but
your cooking.
Add too
and
much
that
salt.
Yeah, yeah. Occasionally they will, you know, if you tick them off, they'll poison you. But, you know, that, you know, yeah. So I love them. I think it's a great concept. And so I have a nice black dress that I'm going to put on, and then I'm going to put on a belt, and I'm going to hang all of my pots and pans from it.
Super.
Yes.
It's going to be great. I'm going to make so much noise. Clang, 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 clang. It's going to be great.
So that does go into the next question. What is Penny going to go as for Halloween?
I looked at her bed, like she's sitting there. She's going as Chucky.
Wait a minute.
There's
wait.
That. There's a somewhere online. There's a GIF of there. Yeah. There's a video of a little bulldog wearing a Chucky costume, and it has a little hand with a knife in it. And so when he walks, and we bought one of those for Penny. We bought it for her last year. It was the smallest they had, and it was way too big for her. It fits her now.
Perfect. Yeah, I was going to say, it was just like, when you say Chucky, there's great. Two that spring to mind, either the killer doll or Chucky Finster. So I had a sneaky suspicion it wasn't going to be the Rugrat.
The killer doll. Killer doll.
So for our final question, we normally ask our guests, and we're going to throw this question at you as well. What is your favorite World Heritage site or your favorite archaeological site or any site that has some kind of meaning to you?
I will have to go with the Indian mounds in the earthworks in Newark, Ohio. And just because that's my hometown, I apologize now. I always say Indian mounds first because that's what I grew up, that was what they were called. That is no longer what we call them. We now call them the earthworks. They are working on making them a World Heritage Site. And it's just a really incredible place. There's a giant circle that was made by the Native Americans there around 2000 years ago. There's also an octagon. And I love the octagon because that is where, so when they came out with and announced at Stonehenge, that they had identified a solar alignment. There were some not archaeologists, there were historians and mathematicians in Ohio that were like, that's nonsense. You know, you can point at anything and it will have a solar alignment. We'll prove it using the octagon mound in Newark, Ohio. And they went to the octagon mound and could not find a single solar alignment. And so I was like, dang it. We went down there to prove that the Stonehenge theory wrong. And instead we proved it right. And they get into the car and they're driving home. And one of their students goes, what about the moon? So the octagon mound has a lunar alignment. And so, yeah, so that's that I would have to go with that. The Newark earthworks.
Thank you so much, Allison, for taking the time to share your PhD and just share your story with us today. We hope you had fun and best of luck with this PhD. We're wishing you the best to finishing it. And once again, it was great having you on the show.
Thank you so much.
And thanks again to all our listeners for supporting the podcast along the way. We always have a pleasure talking to fellow students and with Allison, our newest non-BTU student. So it's great to get to know everyone and hear their different stories and experiences. And we're happy to share them all with you guys.
absolutely again, Austin. It was such a blast. I had so much fun hearing about you and your story and your PhD, master's, everything. It was brilliant to learn about Samoan. And yeah, be sure to check out next week's episode with Maria Segers, a WHS student from the Netherlands of the BTU, who we're really excited to talk to.
Interested in sharing your thoughts and stories? Feel free to contact us. You can reach us on Instagram or by email at the World of Heritage. Thanks again for tuning in. Ciao, adieu, schlan, and goodbye.